Howdy.
Hey, Sasha. How's it going?
Good. I always say hello like a kind of country western caricature. Howdy, Stella.
That's because you're the Americano. Have you noticed I'm going dark and trying to be sexy like Sasha now?
Yeah, your hair looks really good, actually.
Yeah, not quite pulling it off, but yeah. No, I decided I'm naturally dark brown, and I decided I was going back. See,
we've talked a lot about your evolution of hair colors, your gender journey of hair, I guess.
So our conversation with Malcolm was just as exciting as I thought it would be. I've been dying to get Malcolm on. I love Malcolm's work. He's just got this amazing forensic, very, very good attention to detail and the historical origin of gender identity, gender medicine, and he tracks it. And I just think his Substack is a joy. I really think it's really, really, really interesting.
Yeah. So it's his ex profile too. I mean, Malcolm has a history as a producer of science programming, which kind of explains how he does these deep dives, puts together this interesting history, and kind of synthesizes it in also a way that almost like you feel like you're looking at a storyboard. Like you can really see the producer in him when you look at his work, and he's brilliant. Uh-huh. And he's just super likable. I'd love to grab a beer with him and just like talk about things. And you've gotten to do that. And I'm a little jealous.
I came to Glasgow and he said he'd meet me, and he was so good. And we went around Glasgow and went to different sites. And as he said, we ended up in a whiskey bar, but it was just a really nice night. He's a really, really entertaining, interesting personality, person, I should say. So I think it's really important that we have these different understandings of gender, that we don't just talk to, you know, there's kind of a narrative building up, and I love to kind of push it out so that we go to different people. And I just feel the last few guests we've had have been really interesting. I think our move to Substack has been, it's kind of given us a shot in the arm, really, almost, that it feels very exciting on Gender the Word.
Not a testosterone shot in the arm, I'd like to add, but a shot in the arm nonetheless. Yeah, I mean, to just touch on our Substack, we have had some really cool extended conversations with guests that were amazing in the full episodes too. Like we had Sasha Bailey, who really opened our minds to a different way of understanding the contemporary trends around gender, particularly around males, which like there is this narrative that it's either, you know, social contagion or gender or autogynephilia. There is some of that in everything that Sasha said, but man, there's a world, like a technological world that we have not been tapped into. So we highly recommend checking that
out. And it's expanding. The world of gender is expanding. So those neat little categories aren't really fitting because it's getting bigger and wider, and people like Sasha Bailey and his culture are getting into it, and we're trailing behind with these categories because we're a few years behind. What is being said now might have fitted in 2018 or something like that.
The truth is, we're two women. We're both psychotherapists. Yeah. We come at this from a certain angle, and we're not immersed in the world of like crypto bros and tech geniuses. Like, that's not our world. Like, I'm obviously a genius, but not a tech genius. You know what I mean? No, but
I'm certainly not a tech genius.
You might become one day, Stella, if you hang out with Sasha Bailey. So then, like, you know, people like Kathleen Stock, Mia Hughes,
Colin
like,
Wright.
We've had some amazing. Oh, Colin Wright. Yes, it was so good to talk to him. So we just are really happy to be over on Substack, and there's some really great conversations. Like, there's kind of a post in there that we will share updates and news, and there's some really interesting discussions. So please do check out our Substack. You can just join for free or you can become a paid supporter. We really appreciate it. So before we jump into Malcolm, shall I read his bio?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Malcolm Clark is an RTS and Emmy-nominated executive producer. He worked as a producer for BBC's flagship science series called Horizon before becoming the head of science at Mentorn Television. He's also a leader within the LGB Alliance, which was started by Kate Harris and Bev Jackson, who invited Malcolm in the early days to join their leadership team. He's a brilliant writer on Substack and Twitter, or X, and he explores the irrational notion of gender identity and anything else that catches his eye. And as Stella said, he has a particular emphasis on the little known shocking history of concepts within gender and gender medicine itself. So we will let you enjoy our conversation with Malcolm Clark.
Hi, I'm Stella O'Malley, a psychotherapist in Ireland.
And I'm Sasha Ayad, an adolescent therapist in the United States.
And this is Gender, A Wider Lens, a podcast dedicated to the shifting concepts around gender in our contemporary culture.
Through in-depth interviews, personal stories, and psychological exploration, we seek to open up the discourse around this hot-button issue.
Join us as we look at gender from a wider lens. Hello, Sasha and Malcolm.
Hi.
My Hello. Good pal.
Drinking We're buddy.
Yeah, we had a good old night out. I'm going to embarrass myself in Glasgow, and you showed me the sights. It was really good.
Was a whiskey bar. A whiskey really bar in Glasgow is a great place to bond.
It was very Irish Scottish. We were cliches that night.
Totally.
But I'm delighted you've come on. I've been following your work so forensically, really, because you've just brought so much depth to my understanding of gender with your Substack, with your analysis of the historical roots of gender. So I'm really looking forward to getting into all that. I know you're a key founding member of the LGB Alliance, as far as I know. And as well as that, your origin story of how you got into gender is more interesting than most's, I think.
I got involved in the LGB Alliance at a very early stage. It was founded by two lesbians who called me up and said, did I want to come to a secret meeting that would have top level security? And I couldn't be told the location until like an hour before the meeting. That's how things have changed. I mean, it was really difficult for a gender critical organization even to meet in public 5 years ago. But yes, as you say, Stella, my sort of introduction to the whole area of transgenderism or the whole transgender ideology really started around about 1999, 2000, when I worked on the BBC Science Strand, the longest running documentary series in the world called Horizon, which goes out in the States as Nova. We did a lot of work with Nova on PBS. And I was called in they needed a producer to do a quick filming trip. I didn't make the show, but I contributed to it. And it was when my boss, this amazing woman, Bettina Lerner, called me and said, look, I need you to go to Germany. There's a guy who wants to have his leg chopped off. And we've got a date and we're going to be filming the operation. And I need you to go and to Germany and follow this guy as he gets his leg chopped off. I was like, what are you talking about? And so, and it was the strangest gothic trip, because the guy who had got the whole idea together was himself an amputee. He was a producer, a TV producer called Malcolm. Called Malcolm as well. That was weird. Malcolm Nail. So I traveled to Germany with a really nice guy, Malcolm, who was an amputee. He'd lost his leg as a teenager. He was a real amputee, somebody, which is why he got interested in this whole subject. He discovered that there were a whole bunch of people who wanted to be amputees. And he was like, what the fuck? I mean, I lost my leg.
He was a true amputee.
Yeah, and so we traveled. We traveled there and met this guy whose name was Hans. No jokes. And Hans, I know Hans. The thing is that Hans just seemed really normal. He ran a yacht building company. He was a successful businessman. He had kids. He'd always wanted to have his legs removed. And so I was fascinated. But the reason this all connects to the trans story is that the two psychiatrists who approved the three people, I think it was, to get their limbs amputated in a Scottish hospital, ironically, they were the leading figures in trans research and trans... They were the leading psychiatrists who sort of... were the experts in transsexualism. So one of the key people we interviewed, or they interviewed in the show, was Russell Reed, who was the number one expert on transsexuality in Britain. He was a disciple.
Oh my God.
He was taught by John Money, who you may or may not know. That's John Money was originally a Kiwi, and so was Russell Reed was a Kiwi. So I, you know, they. So he came to Britain. He was the number one expert. He's the guy who carried out the experiments using what's now called puberty blockers to castrate sex offenders. The sex offenders actually complained that the puberty blockers were too strong. So, you know, these are adult sex offenders who found the side effects of puberty blockers something they would rather not go through. So, I mean, teenagers now getting them is just absurd. Anyway, Russell Reed in the program said, it's a great line. He said, well, we allow transsexuals to remove healthy parts of their bodies. So what's the difference? And I thought, no, it's the other way around. It's so mad to chop your legs off that it's therefore so mad to chop healthy parts of your body off. But he was looking at it the other way. And as it then turned out, John Money was the person who came up with the term apotemnophile for somebody who's physically turned on by the idea of removing their legs. And that was the big issue. That was another revealing thing for me, another parallel with this debate, because the psychiatrists and the surgeons all assured everybody, the ethics committee at the hospital assured us, that there was no hint of sexual fetish in this. This was a deep, burning requirement of these people to live their authentic life. No, they weren't sexually fetishistic at all. It then transpired a couple of years later that the guy who organized this whole group was the deep sexual fetishist, and they all admitted eventually, about 5 or 10 years later, that was all to do with sexual fetishism. Indeed, the guy who organized all the operations and organized the group then traveled to what was the Harry Benjamin Gender Dysphoria Association and presented papers, and it was all taken very seriously, and they talked about how there were similarities. And then I think even WPATH thought, well, maybe this is a bit weird. Maybe we should retreat. And they were no longer invited. But indeed, the guy whose name escapes me at the moment, but he was interviewed in the show. He was somebody who was complaining that his legs were not being removed, because the hospital had decided that they couldn't cut his legs off. And he complained in the show. He was then arrested 3 years later because he organized the amputation of a 72-year-old guy's, a friend of his. You know, he did what anyone would do for a friend in their 70s. He organized the amputation of the guy's legs, and the guy died on the operating table because it was some rogue surgeon. God. So he was then arrested and accused of complicity.
Oh my God,
what were you going to say?
There's so much there. Yeah. I'm like, I almost want to stop on every sentence here. Could I just?
Yeah, so that's my, that was
say.
Mine.
Baptism by fire. There's a couple of things I want to explore. One is where the crew, the non-amputee kind of group, were they as horrified as you? Were people absolutely shocked? And the second thing is, I want to highlight something that I've seen in mental health and isn't often noted, which is that Hans seemed very, very lucid and sane. And, you know, that is a big thing. If you know somebody who's deep in anorexia, they can seem so perfectly lucid.
Yes.
Perfectly mentally hyped, insightful, awareness, absolutely. And then they might
really
say, but I haven't eaten in 7 days. Yes. And you just think, other than that small section of your life, you would never know that there was mental health going on. It's a key point that people need to know. And it's only when you've kind of really kind of got to know certain other issues that you think that that's a feature. Around their eating.
That's so important.
Yeah.
So important because, of course, this whole movement, which is related to the gender ideology, which is the body autonomy, bodily autonomy movement, now argue that there are papers published. It's all come round again after the horror of 2000 and the hospital chopping legs off. The NHS made it clear it would never happen again, and the surgeon was rebuked, and the health board apologised and said, "Oops, we shouldn't have done this." It was front page news. It was a real scandal. And it was being done on NHS money, apart from anything else, chopping people's legs off.
Malcolm, when was that? What year was that?
I think
the surgery happened.
It was either, actually, you know what? I think I was wrong. It was 2001, I think. 2001. And you can, okay, if you Google it, you'll be able to give us Falkirk Hospital.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's still all there on Google.
Falkirk Hospital, maybe the program.
Yeah. Yes,
it'd be great if we could give it for our listeners, maybe the program or the newspapers around it, because it's out.
We will.
But what I was going to say was,
they apologized, keep going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they apologized, and everyone thought, great, that will never happen again. That was a real weird thing to happen. But now, 20 years later, there are academic papers being published by various professors and people who specialize in medical ethics, which so often is an oxymoron. and these people say that they say things like, well, everyone has the right to bodily autonomy. And they argue now that people who have, it's now a potemnophile is not used because that's been tarnished. It's people who suffer from body integrity dysmorphia. Oh, no, body integrity disorder, I think. Yes, disorder.
They're
arguing now that people have the right to do whatever they want to their bodies. And the guy, his name escapes me, who's written the biggest piece and most influential arguing for this, does what you're criticizing, Stella, which is he talks about these people are rational. They've been interviewed afterwards. They've said it's the best thing they ever did. Hans without the legs in Germany has been interviewed subsequently by this guy. You couldn't make it up, could you? And Hans said it was the best thing he ever did, was get his leg removed.
And can I add, it's body integrity identity disorder, which Malcolm, you're following it all. It feels no accident that there's an identity in the middle of that.
Absolutely.
You know.
Yeah. Because it's what you were saying. It's a mixture of saying that they look completely rational and they're behaving rationally and they're talking in a really sensible, intelligent way about something. And then you add identity, which means how dare you challenge this deep internal thing that nobody can see and nobody can analyze and nobody can measure.
I want to ask about that because I'd like to play devil's advocate in a moment, but I do want to point out that I think in both movements for this body integrity identity disorder and trans identity, you know, I think the fact that there is a sexual component underneath it helps us understand what's going on. And of course, that's not always the case, right? So for example, lots of LGB people transition because they think, you know, they're ostracized for being gender nonconforming or whatever. So this is not always the case. But I just want to point this out because you said at one point, Malcolm, that during this conversation, one of these individuals admitted that there was a sexual fetish involved. Can you just talk a little bit more about what is the nature of that fetish and how does understanding that, whether it's a paraphilia or a fetish or a sexual compulsion, like whatever we want to call it, how does that help us understand the drive to normalize these procedures? I just want to touch on that because it feels really important. It's essential.
No, I think you're absolutely right. Yes. Yeah. Well, John Money, who wrote the first paper about apotemnophilia, it was Greg Firth who was the guy who was in the program and who wanted to get his legs chopped off, who then admitted later that it was a sexual fetish. It was actually Greg Firth who was the subject of John Money's first paper, but he was anonymized. And I think the paper was maybe 1972. And so, the trans movement and the body integrity movements are sort of bubbling up at the same time, and John Money connects the two.
Wow.
But John Money, for all his many flaws, was a brilliant individual, a deeply troubling and dark individual, but he was brilliant. And he analyzed apotemnophilia and compared it to, he didn't say it was identical to transsexualism, but he said that it shared many qualities. And one of them was, he said, that people are being, I mean, it sounds to me it's just like a very extreme form of masochism. He didn't say that. But he said that people were being sexually excited by imagining themselves as helpless, and the thrill was in somehow the overcoming of that mutilation or that deep fundamental weakness, that the amputation. So they were sort of being excited by imagining themselves as damaged and feeling sexually validated by the overcoming of that. And when you think about it, if you just look at what transsexual gender reassignment surgery is all about, it's very similar. It's removing your breasts, it's inverting your penis, castration, all the rest of it. And then afterwards you have arisen again. You have reborn as a more powerful version of yourself. It's a very strange kind of concoction of like a toxic concoction of masochism all the way through. And the other thing, you're absolutely right, Sasha, the reason the sexual part of it is important is if this is a sexual fetish that is so overpowering that you're willing to chop your leg off or castrate yourself, it gives you a clue. I mean, we've all got strong sexual desires, but mine don't go anywhere close to being willing to chop my leg off. And so it suggests a sexual drive is so powerful that, you know, if you encourage it, I mean, well, that's why it's so much of queer theory and so much of the trans movement is all about ignoring obstacles, boundaries, you know, gatekeeping. I have the right to go in here. I have the right to do this. But because in part, not entirely, but in part, it is driven by a really powerful sexual drive, I think.
And it's a body autonomy, bodily autonomy movement. That's where we're going now, yes. If you follow me.
Well, did you see Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Andrea Long Chu, who's a trans-identified male who is into sissy porn and all that stuff? He has argued in New York Magazine that if we really want to liberate trans people, we have to have the courage to back the idea that gender reassignment treatments, and he hinted that it was both hormones and surgery, have to be made available no matter how young a child is and no matter what their psychiatric history is, which is, in a way, is sort of, I mean, of course it's absolutely mad, but it sort of has, that's really the logic that the trans lobby is using, but they just don't say it out loud.
Yeah.
We hope you're enjoying this conversation as much as we are. We just wanted to take a quick moment and say thank you to all of our listeners. Your support helps us to keep the lights on and the mics hot.
We recently made the switch to Substack so we could build a more robust listener community. Visit widerlenspod.com and check out the different subscription tiers.
For just $8 a month, premium subscribers get access to weekly bonus content, discussion posts, and more.
And founding members get the inside track on who's coming up on the show, with the ability to submit their own questions for our esteemed guests.
For those of you who are in need of parenting support and resources, we each have parent coaching membership groups. Plus, you can buy our book, When Kids Say They're Trans.
And if you're watching this on YouTube, don't forget to like and subscribe and get involved in the lively discourse in the comments section.
Thank you so much. Now back to the show. There's also something about this which feels like almost a hyper-rationality. Like, if you can intellectually put your brain into this space, then there's no room for a sort of moral judgment. There's no room for a sort of plea to ethics or whatever. Like, it also feels like, even though it's so mad, it's also hyper-rational in a weird way.
Yeah. Well, you know, Jonathan Swift, he in Gulliver's Travels, he lampooned what was, I think, very young organization at the time, the Royal Society, which were full of boffins and clever people. And he lampooned the fact that these were these really clever people who had these great, really rational ideas that were absolutely insane. If you looked at them from outside, you thought, I can't remember any of the ideas, but they were just absolutely. But well, one of them wasn't one of them that the Irish one that the way to. Well, that, I think that may have that was a satirical paper. I think he did later. But the solution, yeah, the solution to famine problems in Ireland was to eat children, and I mean, it was a
eat
very
your own
rash.
Babies. It was called. Now, he's a satirist, like from the 17th century, and he from Ireland, and he had a paper called A Modest Proposal, where he suggested,
oh,
like,
oh, I know this paper. Yeah. Yes.
And very fun. Yes, you do, Sasha. Yeah. And he said, you know, a solution to poverty was to eat your own babies. And it's so dreadful, but it's the he was being satirical. He's a very intelligent man. But it's the crazy rational. Well, if you're going all the way with this, well, let's go all the way with this. This is where you're going. Like,
And so you're absolutely right, Sasha.
Chilling.
It can seem, it's very well constructed, like some, you know, Jenga puzzle, but actually it's insane. And at some stage that, you know, it's like, my argument is, you know, we've gone along with this sort of rational argument that, you know, the person is all, you know, disturbed, and it would really help them if you do gender reassignment surgery and blah, 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 blah. But actually, at heart, these are people that want to chop their nose off and cut their breasts off. So there's a problem. But society has sort of drifted so far that we're not allowed to say what 10 years ago, 20 years ago would have been blatantly obvious, that there's somebody who wants to castrate themselves, like an anorexic or whatever, has a mental health issue.
Okay, I want to kind of raise just a devil's advocate thing here. So have you heard of the concept of presentism, when you apply the kind of social norms of today onto moments of the past? So for example, you know, like the tearing down of statues of historical figures because also in good. Okay, obviously we don't want to do that retroactively, but I wonder about also the way our current disgust mechanisms are in a different place than they will be. I mean, you are part of LGB Alliance. You know, there's a long history of visceral disgust and ostracization of homosexuality that was probably used as a reason to discourage it, prevent it, etc. So I'm just playing devil's advocate. We obviously have a disgust reaction at the idea of a person who seems totally lucid and rational wanting to chop off their legs. Why is that crazy? And is it possible that we just aren't as enlightened as we will be in 50 years when everyone can chop off whatever fucking body parts they want? Like, I just want to ask, like, why is
Sasha's
it crazy?
Gerson.
I think it's crazy, but I want to know, why is it crazy that is not just like, ooh, because it makes my stomach turn?
Yeah,
is there a rational reason that this is crazy?
I mean, I think actually all of us, even if we thought it was crazy, and I do, if somebody has the money, and they do it already, but if somebody has the money and they're an adult and they're a successful business person and they want to go and chop their legs off, I mean, I wouldn't hunt them down, and I wouldn't spend a huge amount of police effort and everything. Hunt that person down. Don't let them chop their legs off. But I think it was, I've forgotten the second name, Maya, who was involved in the WPATH files. She did a brilliant brilliant thread, which it was really a sort of whatever we think about the rationality or the irrationality of this, what would be the social impact of normalizing it? And she was saying, of course you would get to the point where adolescents who are troubled and mixed up would be getting told by activists, oh, if only you chop your legs off, you'll be fine. And I think that's the argument that I think makes it crazy, or it's the normalization of it that would be crazy. because it would spiral. And the proof of that is what's happened with gender ideology, where most of us didn't really care too much if somebody wanted to. I mean, I wouldn't close gender reassignment surgery down for adults if there are people who are that mad who want to chop their knobs off. I mean, well, you know, can we stop it? I don't know. But it's where it became normalized and put into schools, and then kids being encouraged and four-year-olds being told that they were born in their own body, where you just think, no, wait a minute, this has to be corrected. And I suppose that's my argument. But there's almost, I mean, it's very hard to work out whether your own values are just those of the present.
Yeah, I think you're right. I agree with you. And I think it's the fact that it's in hospitals and it's being described as life-saving as opposed to an extreme body modification clinics where it is personal autonomy. It's the dishonesting of the framing of the description.
Yeah.
If it is bodily autonomy, these need to be bodily autonomy clinics, which offer it with all the risks quite plain to see on the walls that you know what I mean? This is personal autonomy.
Yeah.
And this is extreme body modification that should be in cosmetic clinics. But when we brought in cosmetic surgery, I'd love you to do a history around that. You have to go back and tell us a little bit, because we can't leave this podcast without some of the history, because you've really catalogued the history of gender. But I kind of think that the history of body modification is meeting gender and creating a situation where, you know, mastectomies, you know, breast augmentation, there's a lot of body modification that is perfectly culturally accepted that was not accepted 30 years ago.
Yeah, and certainly in the case of some of gender reassignment surgery, like the phalloplasty, came out of plastic surgery work just after the First World War. And his name escapes me again, but the guy, I mean, there were these soldiers who had been damaged, mutilated by gunfire or whatever, who'd lost their penis. And so that one of the top plastic surgeons who was working on grafts and trying to rescue faces, and he decided that he would take strips of flesh and try to see if he could create a fake penis for these ex-soldiers. And it kind of worked. And, you know, if a guy, these soldiers, there's great reports of the reasons that they did it. They were happily married men, and they were really upset the idea they might not be able to satisfy their wives. And so they hoped that this fake penis could do that. But it was considered very extreme, but it was allowed because the problem was very extreme, or was considered extreme. But it was then in the 1940s that the same guy agreed to do a phalloplasty for a lesbian or a woman who thought she was a man. And that was the beginning of phalloplasty. But it's never been very successful.
My understanding, because I was actually reading up about this yesterday, there's an individual who transitioned to Michael Dillon, and this was apparently the first trans man to have a phalloplasty. And apparently this person underwent 13 grueling surgeries.
Yeah.
And one account that I saw online said that Dillon died at age of 47 due to medical complications, which they didn't really explain what those were. And apparently became a Buddhist monk before she died. So I would be really curious of what happened to that person.
But the most amazing thing about the story was that he couldn't get he got the phalloplasty, but he fell in love. She fell in love. This is where it gets really confusing. She fell in love with a trans woman. A guy. So this woman who thought he was a man, she was a man, fell in love with a guy who thought he was a woman. And the guy who was thought he was a woman, it was illegal to castrate anybody. You know, in most countries, it was illegal to castrate somebody for obvious reasons, a logic that we have forgotten. And the only person that would agree to castrate Michael Dillon's lover was Michael Dillon. So the first man to get gender reassignment surgery in Britain in the late 40s was castrated by the first woman to get a phalloplasty. They were in a relationship together, and the woman chopped the guy's balls off. Yeah. You don't really hear that very often, but it's just jaw-dropping, isn't it?
My God.
Yeah, Michael Dillon chopped a guy's balls off because he was in love with him. And he thought the guy was in love with him. But once the guy got his balls chopped off, he fucked off. And that was good. And that was actually one of the reasons that Michael Dillon kind of got all a bit upset, because he thought he'd found true love in a woman who was really a man. And that sort of fucked up his brain.
What year was that in and around? Like
46, 47. It was just after the Second World War.
I'm always very interested because I see as such the Lily Elbs and the kind of the trans women. They're in history, and you can tell us a little bit about them, Malcolm, because you can trace it right back, and I'd love you to tell us that. But there's often a woman, for example, Michael Dillon, and, for example, Reed Erickson, who was really at the core of a huge amount of the Harry Benjamin, that huge kind of heyday of trans, funded, really, by Reed Erickson, who was born a female. They are there. It's not correct. And people like the narrative that this was all men. Men started, there were autogynephiles, and off we go. Very simple narrative. It's not actually correct. There's a few intense characters who happen to be quite pivotal, Michael Dillon being one and Reed Erickson. I'm not saying they're huge, but they are pivotal.
It suits. I mean, I support feminism and I support feminists, but there is a part of the feminist movement that sees everything through the threat of patriarchy. And of course, patriarchy is huge and permeates everything, but sometimes it means that the story of gender ideology is seen as only patriarchy. And whilst it's very, very important, of course it is, there is another part to it. And the women who play that role, I think, are important, have played an important role, as you suggest, are slightly erased. Now, if I was a radical feminist, I'd probably say, like Sheila Jeffries has, I think, that these women were sort of were really sort of internalizing the hatred of women that the patriarchy creates. Reed Erickson internalized patriarchal misogyny, and that's why she wanted to be a man. I mean, you could never prove either way what was going on in Reed Erickson's mind.
She had a
mind.
Dreadful life. She funded the EEF, which was the Erickson Educational Foundation, which was the precursor to the Harry Benjamin Organization, which was the precursor to WPATH. It went on for about 20 years, but she had like four failed marriages, died of, addiction. It was a miserable, terrible, sad life that she had. But there's something I've always wanted to ask you, and I'm going to put you on the spot because I didn't say I was going to ask you this. I've been studying kind of the evolution of the trans kid, the concept of the trans kid, and there's always been gender non-conforming children in history as far as I can see, and as far as I can see, like, you go back to ancient Greece and you will see that I've read young boys, young feminine boys were sexualized, and that is a kind of a dark side of, ancient Greece and ancient Rome, that there was this kind of sexual element towards these young feminine boys that I would say nowadays would have grown up to be gay, but they were sexualized and there was paedophilia was rampant then. But I don't see where the young gender-forming girls, I can't find much information about them at all. Now, you might have been more interested in the boys anyway, but I'm just wondering, have you seen much in the history about them? Because they don't seem as prominent. Big heyday of tomboys from like maybe the 18th century onwards. Yes. And what I mean? They came in. But pre that, you don't see much of it.
In ancient Greece and Rome erased, just women weren't recorded. So we know so little about women's lives. And it'd be really hard. I mean, they're just zilch. I would say that in ancient Greece there was more. It was adolescent boys, and they didn't have to be feminine. But But there was definitely, yeah. you know, definitely, you know, paedophilia, if you're counting 13, 14, 15, as I think we would as children. But for women, I mean, there are myths in all the mythologies of strong, powerful women, like the Amazons. I mean, the Amazons are huge in ancient Greece, but they were heterosexual. And they were very gender non-conforming. They did everything the opposite of what women were supposed to be, but they were revered. And there were goddesses who were pretty gender non-conforming. Yeah. You know, Artemis was running around kicking shit out of everybody. And, you know, Diana the Huntress and all the rest of it. But I haven't seen much about tomboys or butch girls anywhere. That's quite a new thing.
A gap.
And it may well be that in our culture, it's relatively new because bourgeois society in the 16th, 17th, 18th century created this incredibly mythic sort of feminine mystique of what a real woman was like. And it was constrained and covered in strange clothes and made up and hair primped. And actually, it's a really uncomfortable limitation that's put on women. And I would have thought that some of the tomboy stuff is a reaction against that. If you were a peasant woman, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference if you were a tomboy or not, because you lived a life that was rough and tumble. But once you became a bourgeois, an aristocratic woman, you were sort of, I mean, you weren't allowed to do much. You didn't even go into the sunshine in case your skin was no longer beautiful and white. So it was a horrible sort of restriction that was put on women.
Yeah. And am I right in thinking Magnus Hirschfeld was the first to kind of, he kind of had, like, let's say Charles Darwin kind of had the theory of evolution, and Magnus Hirschfeld in his own way said, no, I've got a better theory. I've got the third sex. Yeah. And that was kind of, homosexuality was the third sex as such, which was the kind of the arrival of transsexual theory. Am I right in thinking that? I know you'd have a better grasp on this than me.
No, I think he's the first one to try. There was basically around about 1860s, there was a gay lawyer. The strange thing is, in the 1860s, neither the word homosexual or heterosexual existed yet. So if you were gay, there was no word for gay. There wasn't. I mean, queer was probably around in some form. There was mollies, was a derogatory term, but there was no way to describe a homosexual. I mean, there were prominent homosexuals. They always forget his name, but one of the top people in Napoleon's circle was blatantly homosexual, and they used to call him La Tante because he was the auntie. But he was so well regarded that when Napoleon attacked Russia and took all his soldiers to Russia, he left France in the care of his right-hand man, La Tante, who was this screaming queen. So you could be openly homosexual in certain places. Interestingly, it was Napoleon who removed the laws against homosexuality. Every country that Napoleon conquered, he removed the laws against homosexuality. I don't know why or how the reasoning was, but it must have been something to do with the fact that he knew a successful right-hand man who was himself homosexual. But in the 1860s, the first person to try to describe what we now call homosexuality, Karl Ulrichs, German lawyer, came up with the term Urning, U-R-N-I-N-G. And this was, he said, I see the problem is right at the beginning of the gay rights movement, there is an early confusion, which has haunted us ever since, because Ulrichs argued that homosexuality was explained by the fact that there was a feminine spirit inside the man. Mm-hmm. And he touched on lesbianism, not very much, because he wasn't that interested, but he suggested the opposite. He gave another word, which is very similar to Urning's, for women who had a little bit of the male spirit inside her. And so that idea that gay men might have a little bit of the female was right from the beginning. And I think it was like 4 years later, after he comes up with the word earnings, that somebody comes up with the word homosexual. And then the two things are put together. And so all the way through the 19th century, the earning remained the term that was most popular for describing homosexual men. And
what does it mean? What does earning mean?
It's a word that goes back to Plato, as I understand it. He took it from classical Greece, and it was a term to do with some mythological figure. I can't remember exactly, but it was a mythological figure that expressed this quality, and he took it deliberately because he said that it was a useful way to describe homosexuality. And then right through to the 19th century, leading figures of what we now consider the gay rights movement used the term earnings. And I'm trying to remember, there was a book, The Third Sex. And it was the 1890s.
The Third Sex.
Oh, no, actually, it was 1911. There was a book, The Third Sex, and that was by a gay rights pioneer. And so Hirschfeld, what Hirschfeld is doing is Hirschfeld takes all these ideas of feminine spirits in men and all the rest of it, and he then puts a veneer of science over it because he's a doctor. And then he creates the first gender spectrum, and he minutely analyzes femininity and men and masculinity and women, and it's almost like he's trying to put a measurement of how much of the female spirit is in the male body, etc. And he develops this idea of transvestitism and transsexuality, and then decides that there's a way to, for some people, he thinks they really are fully the female spirit in the male body, and that you should change the body to match the mind. And that's the beginning of gender reassignment surgery, and which we all know enough.
I've just looked up this earning. So Uranian is a historical term for homosexual men. And Carl, like you say, Carl Ulrichs, a 19th century German lawyer and writer who may have been gay, was the first to label his own community as early as 1862. He used the term earning to refer to men who are attracted to men. We earnings constitute a special class of human gender, he wrote.
Yeah.
I wonder, did he really write gender or did he write sex?
Yeah, I don't know. He wrote it in German, so that might be more confusing still. So Hirschfeld is where it all starts.
We want to take a moment to thank our sponsors, Genspect and Therapy First. Genspect is an international organization committed to fostering a healthy approach to sex and gender. The team and members of Genspect strive to promote high-quality, evidence-based care for gender nonconforming individuals. Genspect is pleased to offer a non-medicalized approach to gender with their recently published Gender Framework, and they continue to hold conferences around the world. Visit genspect.org to learn more.
Therapy First is a non-profit worldwide professional association of mental health providers who view psychotherapy as the appropriate first-line treatment for gender dysphoria. Therapy First supports psychotherapists working with gender dysphoric youth and young adults and offers public education on mental health and psychotherapy. Visit therapyfirst.org to learn more.
Now, back to the show. One of the things trans activists sometimes say is that the Nazis and the eugenics movement targeted transsexuals. And you wrote a very comprehensive X thread about this, which J.K. Rowling recently retweeted. Yeah. So maybe we can talk a little bit about that, because what I've learned from studying this, the history is so complex and so deep and actually so hard to find because of the rewriting of history and the way some activist organizations have kind of twisted up the past. So it's really hard to wrap your mind around the origins of some of these concepts, procedures, interventions. Talk to us a little bit about your research on where transsexuals, as they were called at the time, factored in with Nazi Germany and eugenics. Mm. Tell us about this.
I mean, I I've always, I mean, I think anyone should be interested in the Holocaust. I mean, it's the biggest crime of history. I mean, up there, I mean, I suppose slavery was, you know, another huge historical crime. But the Holocaust is so important because it's in modern times, and it's the only example of a sophisticated, civilized state putting all of its resources into genocide. You know, all modern technology from, mm-hmm. you know, trains to, you know, chemicals, etc. And so it's a really important historical lesson. And I developed shows where I researched it. And I went to Wannsee, which is where the Final Solution was planned. And you know, I've traveled around Germany and I've been to the camps. And so I was already interested in it. So when this claim that trans people were a particular target came up, I thought, well, it's strange. I went to all these places. I didn't see anything about this, but I was willing at first to give it some credence. But then the problem with so much of trans activism is they take an idea which you think, okay, you know, I don't feel too strongly either way. And then they twist it and they twist it. And then eventually it becomes the Holocaust is about trans people. And it's that stage I thought, yeah. Now let me have a look. And I sort of imagined that when I did look at it, I thought, look, if I find that there's maybe a couple of hundred, maybe even 1,000 trans people who were, you know, murdered, I wouldn't have been surprised because the Nazis were appalling and the Nazis hated anybody who disagreed. I mean, they put jazz musicians in the camps because they hated jazz. If you were a jazz fan and you were found to be listening to jazz records, you were given a warning. And if the Gestapo came back and you hadn't got rid of your Gestapo records, you were in real trouble. So if that's how bad they were and crazy they were, the idea that, I mean, of course they would like trans people. So I sort of assumed there'd be a lot of victims. And so I was really amazed when I looked to find that the evidence was the very opposite. And I was amazed at the hyperbolic claims. And so there was somebody kept saying, when I said I wasn't sure about this, somebody said, oh, you should watch this video. It's 4 queer experts on the Holocaust, and they're talking about the targeting of the trans community. So I sat down to watch this, and I was amazed to discover that they gave 4 names. There were only 4 people, and they'd spent their entire or most of their recent academic career searching for names, and they could come up with 4. And then I looked at the 4, and 2 of them were Jewish. Well, if you know anything about the Holocaust, you don't have to be. If you're Jewish, your number's up. You know, you better flee. The idea that they're going to, oh, we must go and get the trans Jewish person before the other Jewish people is just rubbish. It's just not true. And it's, you know, it's a sort of insult to the sort of the crime of the genocide of Jewish people to somehow think that there was a pecking order where trans Jewish people were gone for first. And then, you know, for example, I did my thread. I went through and I looked at all the evidence, and it's just nonsense that trans people were particularly targeted. And then today, actually, I did another thread because there's been so much reaction to J.K. Rowling's retweet that I've had all these trans activists saying, I'm a Holocaust denier. They claim that J.K. Rowling is a Holocaust denier, which is absolutely outrageous. And so but part of the reaction was Pink News, nobody's idea of a serious news outlet, ran a big piece about the trans victims of the Holocaust. And there were a couple of new names. And so I went through all of the people, 5 people this time, that it listed. Probably because Benjamin Cohen is Jewish himself, they didn't use any of the Jewish trans people from that video discussion, which, you know, fair play to them. Benjamin will know that the idea that the trans is not the reason why Jewish people were put in a concentration camp. But there were 5 people there. I went through them, and it's just unbelievable. One of them is a guy who was arrested. He was warned for cross-dressing. Gert is his name. And But he wasn't arrested for cross-dressing. He was arrested because the guy had a real mental problem. He kept, believe it or not, I'm not making this up, he was arrested because he kept hiding in the neighborhood's communal garbage bins, and then he would be found naked and filthy in the garbage bins. He was arrested under public indecency laws, nothing to do with cross-dressing. And when he went to a concentration camp, his doctors managed to get him out because they said, no, he's got a mental issue, but he's not homosexual, he's heterosexual. He had been happily married. And so he was brought out and he was put in a mental institution where he committed suicide. He would have been put in a mental institution in any country in the world in 1939. If you were hiding naked in garbage bins, you'd be put in a mental institution today, probably. Or you'd be given some drugs. And,
as far as I know, 10,000 to 15,000 gay men were killed during the Holocaust. They were targeted.
There was a specific law against homosexuality, and most of the people who are counted as trans, a substantial number, if they're not Jewish, a substantial number are homosexual, who would have gone to they would have been arrested anyway if they were homosexual. You didn't have to cross-dress. Some of them, one of the people, the other thing about these five people in the Pink News rundown, the astonishing thing is, if you look at it carefully, only one of them was ever actually killed. Of the other four, Gert committed suicide. The gay transvestite died in the 70s. Another one died in the 90s. They all survived because, and my point is, you could never say that about the Jews. The Nazi state, its number one priority was to hunt down Jews. Absolutely. And kill them. It was just nowhere near. And if you look at the other figures, you know, there were 80,000 Freemasons were murdered. Freemasons? I mean, the Nazis had very specific targets. The Roma, homosexuals
one of many, and, you know, the handicapped, the gypsies. But I was going to ask you is, I saw a picture. It was like from Nazi during the regime of all these cross-dressing Nazis. Did you see what I'm talking about? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes. No, absolutely. There is another, you know, I've had quite a few people, I get slightly irritated, a few people come on to the thread saying, not only weren't the trans people a target, they really were the Nazis. Look at these pictures. I say, look. I just don't buy it. There was 5 million soldiers that the Nazis had. So there were a lot of soldiers, and if you look at every other army, a lot of soldiers dressed up and cross-dressed because there was no women at the front.
Yeah.
And they dressed up. I just don't buy the idea. I agree with you. Yeah.
I think there's a kind of a decadence of there's a kind of a madness that comes over soldiers who are at war, and that they're kind of doing extraordinary things.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? When they're in during wartime, that I think is just, it's not like their real life. They go to war and they bring out the extraordinary in them. Can I ask you something before we go to the exclusive content? What is your answer to when somebody says there's always been trans, because you've followed the history, what is your answer? There's always been trans people, because that's the big question that people say, you know.
I just think you've got to keep an open mind. I wouldn't be surprised if somebody found a gene that sort of didn't always express itself in transness, whatever that is. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if somebody found a bit of the brain that tends to be more common in people who think they're the opposite sex. It wouldn't surprise me. It's amazing that, you know, after 50 years of looking, they have found absolutely nothing in our biology that indicates makes people gravitate towards transness. I presume there always were people who, a tiny, tiny minority who kind of identified with the other sex to the extent that they really somehow thought they were. I mean, the Chevalier d'Eon, who was a spy and an amazing swordsman, he dressed up as a woman, and this is in the late 1790s, early 1800s, and came to Britain. Maybe it was slightly earlier. It was Louis XV, so it was 1780s onwards, 1760s onwards. And anyway, he was the most notable example, and nobody could work out, was he a man or was he a woman? He dressed as a woman, but he was a swordsman, and everybody knew he had been a soldier at the front and had been a man. And I think when they did the post-mortem, he had all the bits that made him a man. Mary Wollstonecraft, who, you know, is a founder of feminism, was a big supporter of the Chevalier. And in fact, they're buried just feet away from each other in the same graveyard. And so the Chevalier is a perfect example of there's always going to be some people who identify so strongly with other sex, they somehow delude themselves that they are the other sex. And if they do, it doesn't matter. It's only when they start making claims on the rest of society where we have to validate their delusion for more than just politeness, but we have to change the law or give them access to spaces that they're not, you know, they shouldn't be in.
Yeah, the history is so important to understand because, you know, it reminds me a bit when we spoke, Stella, with Bob Ostertag, who wrote the book Science, Sex, Self, kind of about the history of hormones. Yeah. And he was saying, you know, so many people that I know and love are taking these substances, but don't know anything about the history of where they came from, how they were marketed, how were they developed. So, I mean, I feel a similar kind of level of importance here to understand the history of the ideas and the concepts. So it's been really great to talk with you. And for the, we'd love to kind of take this conversation into the listener exclusives, but of course we'll share the links that you send us. We'd love to share with our audience your programs that you worked on for BBC.
And your Substack. I can't recommend your Substack more. It's really, really good.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Anywhere else that you would like people to go?
I've done some pieces in The Critic magazine and in Spiked. That's where most of my articles are. But the Substack is where I put the longer ones in, yeah.
Okay, that's great. Well, we'll make sure to include those, and I guess we'll sign off for here, and we'll see you in the next segment.
Great. Let's catch up again in 5 years' time and see what madness has happened.
I'd love that. Hopefully sooner. Thank you, Malcolm.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us this week on Gender, A Wider Lens.
If you enjoyed the show, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify.
And be sure to visit us on Substack by going to widerlenspod.com. There you can join our listener community, access bonus content and resources, plus learn about additional ways to support the show.
Our discussions are for educational purposes and are not intended as a substitute for mental health services.